Good afternoon. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. Can you hear me, Doyle? Am I going out? I can't tell. I can't hear myself.
Turn them headphones up.
Well, I'm trying. I can't find the deal. Can't find the handle. It's not the only thing I can't find. I am in here today, and I am utterly unprepared for today's show. So, okay, folks, I'm going to need your help. I'm going to need your help to do today's show. Can you turn my level up a little bit? Okay. So I was in a meeting today. I was in I got a new client, and that made me feel really good. I love that. There's nothing like, when you're in my business, there's nothing like getting a new client. No, it's just this. Just hang on. hang on. I'll tell you. This is the replacement.
This is a replacement laptop.
So I'm sitting in the client meeting. I'm about to show them the portfolio that I've designed to invest their retirement savings in.
We're talking money.
Yeah. And I'm in the middle of that, and suddenly my notebook computer that I'm projecting up on the wall dies. Just flat out.
What happened? What is die?
It just went gazonk.
You mean it like went to black?
Yeah.
Not blue?
No.
Not the famous
no.
blue screen?
It just went gazonk. And I'm like, well, okay, just a minute, please.
Were you on the battery?
It was plugged into the AC thing in the wall. So it just went totally gazonk, and it took with it my whole show outline for today also. So I had my whole show outline. I'd prepared it last night, and it hadn't yet
all that work.
Right. It hadn't yet backed itself up. So I had links to these articles I was gonna, and so I'm in here today. I'm totally unprepared. It's not usually the case. I usually know what I'm going to be talking about. And so here we are. And I thought, all right, maybe what I'm going to talk about is the product quality, poor product quality epidemic, I think, that we are suffering from in this world today. And so I saw my friend Otis in the lobby. I said, Otis, will you come on and do the show today? Because I'm probably going to need you to bail me out because I'm not prepared.
You could do it.
I don't know.
I've seen you talk about things you don't know anything about. Mm-hmm.
And so that's really, I think, what I want to start off with today. It also dovetails with another thing that happened to me earlier this week. And that is that I found a pamphlet, an old pamphlet, like a product pamphlet from the Epiphone company. Do you know what that is, Epiphone?
Epiphone.
You know what that is, Epiphone?
I remember the name. What do they make?
Doyle, you know what Epiphone is?
Oh, yeah, they make guitars.
They make guitars.
Oh,
right.
It's
Epiphone guitars, right.
They're still a subsidiary of Gibson.
I think they are now, but they didn't start that way.
They didn't start that way. They started way back in the beginning of the 20th century with a Greek immigrant and his family who came to America. We had a very common story back then. His name was Stassopoulos or something like that. And he had a son named Epi.
Huh.
Was his nickname. And that he was a luthier.
Ah.
He was a lost art. A lost art. He had learned to make guitars and mandolins and other instruments in his home country of Greece. And he came to the United States in the early... This is what I got. This is the pamphlet I found that went with my Epiphone guitar I found the other day. Somehow it was somewhere. And as Doyle knows, I've been playing my Epiphone guitar more. And this pamphlet is in there, tells the story of this Greek family that came, and he and his brothers and brother-in-law, and they started a company, and they called it Epiphone, to make guitars and mandolins.
To compete with Stella.
Yeah. Is that who it was back then?
Well, Stella was the great cheap guitar maker.
they sold them at Sears.
Yeah, Stella? And Stella, yeah. Stella right. invented the 12-string. The legitimate 12-string is actually Stella.
Lead Belly played that 12-string.
He had a special one that they made for him, and he had to hold it on his knees because it was so big. But I've had five 12-strings, and four of them have been stolen, including a special one, a Martin, and a Stella. And the Stella was by far the most interesting 12-string. But anyway, that's a totally different subject. And the quality of Stella, they never suggested that it had any quality. Yeah. So you were never disappointed with a Stella.
Right, but it's still better than most of the cheap stuff they make now.
Yeah.
Well, right. So this company, Epiphone, this Greek family, built their business over the years. And even during the war years, the pamphlet was very, very informative. It explained that during the war years, the Second World War, all resources went to the war effort. So there was no room for making guitars, mandolins, banjos, and so forth, things that the Epiphone company specialized in.
No, they made, what, bomb diffusing devices.
I guess every lathe and machining tool was used to make bombs. And this affected the Epiphone company, but they got out of it, and then the business boomed in the 1960s with the rock revolution that occurred with the Beatles, and Epiphone was eventually acquired, as Doyle pointed out, by the Gibson Guitar Company, based in Tennessee.
Didn't somebody play the Epiphone? Wasn't there somebody who played an Epiphone?
George Herbert Walker Bush, I think. There's a picture.
That's pitiful.
A lot of people played Epiphones, especially back in the old days, like with Stella and all that stuff. They made a lot of good acoustic guitars.
Yeah.
So the pamphlet goes on then, and my guitar dates back to the 1990s, all right? And I think the guitar was made around 1993 or 94, something like that. And the last chapter of this pamphlet that I found, that went originally and accompanied the guitar I have, guitar I love, discusses the recent improvements and enhancements in the manufacture of the Epiphone guitar line. What had begun as a manufacturing craft in Greece had then moved to this country, the United States of America, in the 20th century, and had come into the hands of American craftsmen and manufacturers who learned how to do it in the factories of Epiphone and Gibson. As they indicate in the pamphlet, how proud they were when this pamphlet came out in the 1990s that they were now shipping off the manufacturing process to other countries. To other countries.
And they were proud of it.
To Japan. And to, at this time, Korea. My guitar, I think, was made in Korea. Very fine guitar. Sounds very, very fine.
Yeah, they're good. I mean, the Takamine guitars, which I think are Japanese, aren't they?
Yeah, some of the Japanese and Korean guitars are pretty good, especially the Japanese. But when they're starting to make them in China, which a lot of the cheaper ones are made now, they're not near as good.
Nope. So all this has got me thinking about these movements of human labor capital and manufacturing capital. As we look at survey the state of the world right now, and I am sitting here on a day when a PC that I got maybe 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago,
okay,
a notebook made by Hewlett Packard
should still be alive, has
just croaked in the middle. And I got to tell you, it's not the only thing that's croaking. I had a power adapter croak on a router the other day. I mean, it is. So my question to the listening audience today is: am I crazy, or is there a quality crisis going on that has been brought on by a disdain for a willingness to pay for proper manufacturing techniques, taking all of these manufacturing jobs in this country where there was a manufacturing infrastructure here, a know-how, a culture? It's now been shipped off. I'm not saying that Americans have a right. Hang on. I'm not saying Americans have a right to have a job more than Chinese or anybody. Everyone in this world should have a right to work. But, you know, has it gone too far when the stuff starts breaking? And everything I buy these days, I mean everything, seems to break.
Can I?
Yeah, yeah.
I have a burning
please.
Chair.
And by the way, you're now hearing the voice of Otis McClay, who is my friend and mentor. May I say that?
I guess.
who has graciously agreed to bail me out today.
I'm also heard
with Mark Babawi on Monday.
Yes, you are.
But I'm just the sidekick. But here, I'm the mentor. No.
Yeah.
This is my overall statement, that this is what I have, the philosophical position that I've taken from thinking about this. What I see in general in our corporations, the big shift in our corporate culture was from people who were very proud of what they made, like, you know, Henry Ford, the great anti-communist, you know, as right-wing as you can possibly get, who was extremely proud of the product that he produced, and even went so far as to say, remember, they can have any color they want as long as it's black. And he's very concerned about the quality of the product. And he's the guy sitting up in the front office who's in charge of the whole thing, is concerned about the quality of the product. I think the great shift in the corporate culture is away from that to the bottom line. So now everything is concerned about the bottom line. And I don't mean the bottom line over a period of years. I'm talking about the quarterly report. And so all of the decisions in most corporations now are made for that bottom line. That's one of the reasons we send stuff to cheaper labor overseas. One of the reasons that we would automate certain processes that were previously done by hand. You use the word craft either in a you know, about five times when you were talking about the guitar, about Epiphone, and, yep, and even about the laptop that died. There's a huge move away from craft. Craft is, you know, making a guitar.
But
a luthier is a craft, and they learned that craft over a period of time by apprenticing and by doing, and eventually became very good at it.
But, I mean, you mentioned Henry Ford. Wasn't Ford himself a move away from craft or from tinkering, right? I mean,
it was a
move into manufacturing.
Actually, it was Colt, and assembly
line manufacturing.
Yeah, it was Colt. It was actually Colt.
Yeah. And then we have McDonald's, which produces food the same way. It's the assembly line production of food,
yeah,
where essentially humans are no longer called upon to do all the tasks and be artisans who understand
right.
the entire process. They're just cogs that produce one piece of the process.
I would sort of defend Colt and when I say Colt, I'm talking about Colt Firearms. What Colt did that was unique up to the time Colt began making firearms, and of course the great peacemaker, which was the gun that killed the West,
won the West.
Guns were all made individually, so that the parts were not interchangeable. And what Colt did was make all of the parts the same, so that you could interchange the parts.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge
I didn't know that.
Change in how stuff was made. And it is a move away from craft in a sense, but at the same time, in order to be able to do that, you got to have somebody who really knows what he's doing to make that stuff.
Yeah,
no,
Doyle,
you can't talk,
Doyle. Jump in, Doyle.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I think the main problem is a systematic issue that Americans just want to have all this stuff. And if they really just use their money to invest in things that not only don't break, but also actually do a service for them, instead of spending it on junk that you buy at Wally World. I won't say the actual name, but you know, just stuff that gets thrown away as soon as you buy it. It's worth nothing.
I want a computer that works, and so
but you'd be more willing and able to buy those things at a higher price.
Well, I would like to buy an Apple notebook. I mean, I know this is not the Technology Bite Show, but really it is the Technology Bite Show today, because
you got bit.
Yeah, stuff bit me, and I'd like to buy and I'd like to own and use an Apple notebook, but I've got several pieces of software that have to run on Windows for my business.
Oh, but you could do that.
Well, but then you got to do this switch thing, right? You got to swap back and forth. Hard to do or not?
I have a Mac Pro at home.
Okay.
And the editing tool that I use for video and for audio, Vegas, only runs under Windows.
So what do you do?
So I apologize to my Mac Pro, and then I boot it as Windows.
So you got to reboot the computer.
If I'm going to do that.
See, I can't do. I'm going back and forth between this stuff all the time.
Well, there's another thing. There are two ways of doing it with a Mac. One is with a thing called Parallels,
uh-huh.
which means that it'll run under Windows, even though you haven't rebooted.
So it pops up a Windows window within the Mac.
And the other thing is, since you don't have a Mac and you haven't explored it, you don't know what possibilities there may be. For instance, a lot of the Microsoft stuff will run on the Mac, like Word. What do we got?
Well, finish up. That's MTA. Nita's holding, but we'll take her call.
Oh, yeah. By all means, take the call. Callers first. But I'm saying that there are a lot of options. One of the things Mac has done is to really keep the quality of what they do up. When I look inside the Mac Pro, and I have PCs and stuff, that Mac Pro, it's like you look in, there are no wires.
So
it's just like perfect. Yeah. You want to change a drive, you just pull the thing out.
But I mean, again, my question put to the callers today is there a product quality crisis resulting from this global manufacturing system? I know that half the stuff I buy at Home Depot could be a sprinkler head. It could be a sprayer that goes on the end of my hose, lasts about 6 months.
Houston Water.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the old day, it was, what about Houston Water? It comes from the Trinity River and goes.
There's a lot of calcium in it. It'll clog it up. You got to clean
it out. Anyway, so maybe we'll go to the phone.
I know what you're saying.
Let's give out the note. 713-526-5738. This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. And sitting in with me is my friend Otis McClay. And we're talking about. Today we're talking about product quality. Is there a product quality crisis? I'm in today totally unprepared. My computer died just a few hours ago.
There's a product quality crisis on the New Capital Show.
So all these themes are intertwined. There's a product quality crisis of the show today because it took down my my outline.
That's just maddening. I mean, that's just nuts, you know,
I mean, it'd be one thing if it was just the first time it happened, but I've got to tell you, it's like every single computer I've ever had, it just dies after a couple years. Mm. And it just doesn't seem right. Anyway, let's go to the phones. 713-526-5738, 526-KPFT. First up is going to be Nita on line one. Nita, welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, I think part of the problem is they've dumbed people down. They expect things to break, and if a sprinkler lasted you 6 months, you were lucky.
So you too share this experience that I'm having.
Oh, goodness, yes. And I do think that in the first place, if you shop at home mom-and-pop stores, which are declining horribly, you can get a quality product. You might pay more for it, but it lasts longer. But most people are too lazy to do that. They'd rather go to Wally World and buy their groceries and everything else at the same time.
And when you do that, you keep those people in business, which is just so important for our economy, you know.
Yeah, and yes, you do. And I pointed out to a girlfriend I had, every time we went to Wally World, we took back almost as much as we bought.
Yeah, you got to go back three or four times before you get the one that works.
Yeah.
So
they've dumbed us down.
Mm-hmm.
People are lazy.
And they got people to trade their jobs for that, right? Oh, you're going to be able to buy a lot more stuff, right, Nita? And
yes.
It's all going to be cheaper
But it's not really cheaper in the long run.
It's more costly. Which is what the New Capital Show is ultimately about, the true cost of things.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not cheaper.
Nita, thanks for the call. Great to have you.
Bye.
Otis, you know, the Germans have somehow managed, I'm sure not totally, but they have not been willing to negotiate away their manufacturing economy.
Well,
they have maintained elements of that, and their economy is very strong.
They have done all of the things that our corporate media tell us destroy economies and make things expensive.
Yeah.
They have very strong unions in Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
They still have craftsmen. Everything has not, they have not outsourced a lot, probably most of their manufacturing, and yet they continue to be the most robust economy in the world right now, I guess, you know, or at least it's
the most balanced.
The most balanced.
It's really
in Europe.
The most balanced.
It's the only one that's not really being hammered.
Yeah.
What else is there in Europe that's not being hammered? France is hammered.
Well, I just think if you're looking across the world, what you can say about the German economy is it appears to be well balanced. It's It's
they don't have a lot of poverty. They have a medical system that's pretty much what we would like to call socialized medicine. They have strong unions. They pay decent wages.
And
they have vacations.
And just a matter of years ago, they had to absorb the entire East German economy that was flat on its back and had been ruined from totalitarianism.
And now they're absorbing Greece. I mean, they're absorbing all of the other economies, which are doing what these economists tell them is this, you know, austerity stuff and cutting and so forth, what we're getting hammered with here. And it's interesting. You look at this and it's like, well, their economy is really working and they're doing everything that we say is wrong. And our economy sucks. And Greece, of course, and Spain are the biggest examples. Or Portugal, which did everything they said in austerity.
Yeah.
And Portugal is absolutely dead.
By the way, everybody, mortgage rates in the United States have now hit a 15-year low. The 30-year mortgage is now nationwide at 3.88%. So if any of you own a home and you have a mortgage with some substantial amount of money, say $100,000 or more in a mortgage, just FYI, you may want to investigate refinancing your mortgage because mortgage rates are quite low.
See, one of the problems we have is what everybody knows.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that if work is cheap, then the product will be cheap. You know, you won't have to spend much for it. But, of course, you're not focusing on the quality of the product, which is exactly what you're saying.
What about the cost and the environment, too, with shipping everything halfway across the world on tankers?
I have a whole thing about glass and, you know, local bottling companies and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about that, our structure has completely changed.
Another thing for poor people like me, if you can't afford the good American stuff.
You are not poor, Doyle. You are very rich. And I've tried to explain that to
you. Okay, well, thank you.
Insanely
but for,
rich.
For monetarily shorthanded folks like myself.
That'd be all right to say.
you know, you can buy used things. You know, and even if it's made overseas, you're not putting that environmental cost on the world. And, you know, I do that all the time. Use clothes and, you know, use things at garage sales and stuff like that. And it's cheaper and you don't have to destroy the world for it.
We also have a culture. We have a culture that starts in school where if you don't wear the right clothes in school, you're considered, you know, really lower class and they really hammer you.
Mm-hmm.
And that changes, obviously, every couple of weeks. You know, you have to have a different pair of shoes to be one of the crowd. And our whole system is based on this generating needs that don't exist, making you need something that you don't really need.
Right, let's go back to the phone, 713-526-5738-526 KPFT on an unprepared New Capital Show day, a day in which my notebook computer died in the middle of a presentation.
Callers to the rescue.
Callers to the rescue. Otis to the rescue. Let's go. Does Scott call your show, Otis?
I don't. No, we don't do phone calls.
You don't do phone calls?
Not on the monitor.
Right, we're going to take Scott's call. Scott calls me every week, but that's
good.
All right. That's okay. Hey, Scott.
Hi. I have been rereading books about the Soviet Union and the demise of its empire.
Mm-hmm.
I have been reading about the kind of government you Democrats want to bring to America.
Mm-hmm.
Us Democrats?
Do you think I'm serious? No.
We're all
we want an entirely revolutionary government, you know, where I'm in charge.
Yeah, there are people who compare Democrats to communists, and it's still a viable argument among many people in this country. And really, they're being about as ideological as the Soviets were.
Yeah.
Stalin used ideology as a political weapon. He
killed 14 million people.
He'd sent people to the firing squad for ideological deviations that might have been perfectly good ideas 2 weeks before.
I'm just thinking of the famine in the Ukraine.
Yeah. He forced collectivization, but he was brutal with his cabinet.
Scott, what are you reading? What book are you reading, if I might ask?
Well, let's see. David Remnick's book is called Lenin's Tomb.
Yeah.
Also now, and this is more about Eastern Europe, Lighting the Night by William Itchikson.
David Remnick, of course, is the editor of The New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker, a very fine scholar.
Yeah.
I think he may have taught for a bit at Rice University. or some, I may be wrong about that, but a fine journalist and a fine scholar, and a Russian scholar.
Remnick has written a biography of Obama, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, yeah. Scott, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Otis, anything you want to say about the Soviet Union? I lived there for about 6 months back in 1986, and
I'm still waiting to see communism tried as an experiment. Haven't seen it yet.
You know,
maybe in Cuba.
You know, the problem is this.
People in Cuba.
Anytime you get a society that is, and I think the word Scott used is right, ideological, and says that the society economically must be all for the collective, you have a problem. And anytime you have a society that says the society must be all for the individual, you have a problem.
Yeah.
Either of those ideological extremes, you are not going to have a successful society.
Right.
There has to be room for the individual and the communal. In any political economy.
I was just going to give an example. The Pilgrims, when the Pilgrims first came here, and it was an interesting group, and they were not connected to anybody else when they first showed up.
Yeah.
Their first form of agriculture was what we would call communist. In other words, everybody grew, and then they put everything into the common plot.
I went to Plymouth Plantation this summer, this past summer. I was there.
And they starved every winter.
Yeah.
And I think it was after about 6 years, Governor Bradford, they changed the system and said, you grow what you want, and then we're going to put a certain amount into the common common pool, and you keep the rest.
Didn't know that.
Production doubled.
It's like, it sounds like fair taxation.
Because there was some of both.
Yeah.
And why
they had the consciousness of the community.
Yeah.
They had the concept that the community was valuable too, which we actually used to have in this country until Ronald Reagan.
So why is it so hard for people to say, I accept that there are segments of our economy and our society that are individual in nature and those which by necessity are communal in nature, are social in nature? Well, that seems to me to be so obvious, and it seems to me to be such a clear conclusion as to the human experience.
But doesn't it make you
that it just should be?
Doesn't it make you feel good to know that you did it all yourself with no help from anybody? You never breathed the air.
Yeah, right.
That you needed a cop for. Yeah.
That's the other extreme, you know? I mean, it's like, it's almost as if the Cold War drove a wedge and created these two different monsters of two different extremes.
That may be right.
And, you know, hopefully one day we can meld it together and have a peaceable conversation, you know?
Let's go back.
What is it about us humans that makes us not do that? I mean, the whole thing about this economy thing with Germany as an example of a thriving economy, and we ignore it because ideologically we want this other system, you know?
Okay, back to the phones, everybody. 526-5738, 526-KPFT, and you know the area code, 713. Anthony is up next. Anthony, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, hello.
Hello.
Hey. The problem, in my opinion, with the lower quality of manufacturing goods rests solely on the consumer and you and I. It's our fault.
Okay.
We're the ones who allow it to happen. And the last invention in mechanical engineering was the O-ring in World War II. And so everything since then has just been improvement of design. The thing is,
say that again. The last what?
The last major invention in mechanical engineering was the O-ring in World War II.
Is that true? There's been no major invention in mechanical engineering since the O-ring?
Well, there hasn't been improvements. There's been improvements. Everything really since then, that was like the last revolutionary idea. Everything else since then has been, how can we refine this better? How can we make these teeth on these gears fit together
just
closer?
Just out of curiosity, you're saying that the revolution was the method of manufacture of the O-ring? That it was somehow...
No, he's saying the O-ring itself.
Or the invention of
the O-ring.
The invention
of the O-ring.
The invention of the O-ring.
Right.
And then since then, it's just been improvement of design. We can now drill with closer and closer accuracy. We can do stuff like
I'd have to mention the reciprocating engine, but you know.
Okay, all right, well.
That's been around for a long time and never changed.
Well, my point, though, is that we the consumer have become, we see these cheaper prices and we want the cheaper prices.
Yeah, right.
It hasn't become more expensive to manufacture anything. We've just become used to a lower quality.
You,
and then when something breaks, we throw our arms up in protest and saying, what is wrong?
So do you think, I mean, I feel, Anthony, like I'm learning my lesson. Like I won't chase that low price anymore. I feel like here in 2012 and with all the product failures that I've experienced in a vast range of different products, from garden hose sprayer tips to PC computers to automobiles to, I mean, you name it. Anything that I've bought seems to have been breaking. I can't be alone. I feel like I'm learning a less. I feel like I've learned, and I'm willing to pay a higher price to get something that works. Do you think other people are learning that as well?
Well, slowly, I think. Too slowly. Our economy has grown so large. Back in the day when it used to be small, you could walk down and meet everybody in your town and nudge them and say, don't buy Jim Bob's, you know, horseshoes. He has lower quality. Buy Mike's horseshoes.
Yeah.
But we've gotten so big that we can't tap everybody on the shoulder, and so now we have to figure it out for ourselves.
What do you mean? We've got Amazon's star rating system and Angie's List and all kind of ways to find out what's what.
Yeah, but science shows that we believe the guy who taps us on the shoulder. We believe our buddies more than any sort of other science or any sort of aggregator. We believe the guy standing next to us to our own detriment.
Yeah, word of mouth. Word of mouth, big, very, very, very big.
That's called affiliation theory. That you tend to ascribe. It's a condition of human psychology that we tend to ascribe greater weight to something that is affiliated to us than any sort of statistical measure. So, for example, if your next door neighbor buys a car and it breaks, he got a lemon, you will not be inclined to buy the car because your neighbor had a bad experience, even if that car gets the highest rating from Consumer Reports in the history of automobile.
And he just got a lemon.
He just got the lemon. So anyway, Anthony, thanks. Great to have you on the show.
Take care.
Doyle.
Hey, Leo. Yeah, I wanted to say something about the consumer responsibility. I'm all for that, and that's where we're at now, I really believe. The thing is that the government is also supposed to protect the consumers through fair trade practices. And the world trade system that we've developed over the last 20 years, which is really actually pretty new, has basically tipped the scale of fairness. And that's the reason why we've gone in this position where we have no manufacturing. We're buying cheap stuff that's shipped halfway across the world. Makes no sense.
I understand, Doyle, but The government of the U.S. isn't going to save us from this product quality epidemic.
But they're the one that put us there, and they weren't supposed
to. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe we all put ourselves
there.
Well,
we used to have a tariff, right, for anything that was made by slave labor, and now it's free.
Well,
free trade.
Let me ask a question, though. What about lying? How do we feel about lying? Because, you know, I was in advertising. I was very good at it, and I got out because I was good at it. Basically, what we're doing when we advertise is lie, either lie by omission or lie by completely changing the subject. I mean, if I were going to teach a class in commercials and how to look at commercials, the first thing I would have to say is commercial has nothing to do with the product.
Yeah, right.
You know, you could get a guy who's brilliant. In 100 years, we won't be looking at the television shows in our, you know, the Museum of Modern Art. We'll be looking at the commercials because our greatest artists are doing that.
I went to lunch with a friend today, and he had gotten a box from Zappos, the online store, and he said, oh, it's great. They give us free shipping. And I said, there's nothing free.
Yeah.
What do you mean free shipping? When you hear the word free, your antenna ought to go up.
Exactly.
There's no such thing as free in the world of marketing, business marketing.
It's cash back on credit cards.
Right.
And I mean this craziness.
Everybody wants something for nothing. Yeah. Everyone wants something for nothing, Otis, and they want free, and they want free lunches. And after, you know, 2008, Americans should have learned there's no free lunch. You've got to pay the resources or the money or the energy or the effort, whatever it is, to get something out.
Well, but I'd have to say that there are ways of saying, how much of this actually goes to the product and how much of this actually goes into somebody's bank account.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea that the shipping from Zappos is free is just absurd. No, I mean, it's not free.
In fact,
something's paying for it.
This past Christmas, free shipping was a big issue, and it cost a lot of companies a lot of money.
Yeah.
It really hurt them.
All right, let's go back.
Just to say free shipping.
Let's take Charles on line six. Charles, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi there.
Hey.
I'm just visiting from Pittsburgh. I grew up here. I'm glad and I found you. And you were here when I left, and your station's still here, and I really enjoy listening to
you. We are glad to have you today. Are you just visiting? How long are you visiting for?
Oh, a few days.
I went to Carnegie Tech. I just want to say
that. You went to Carnegie Tech.
I love this topic because the person who mentioned being in advertising really kind of hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, see?
So a couple of points I'll make, and then I'll listen to your comments. One is that Germany is one of the leading licensees in Europe. They do export and license a lot of foreign manufacturing of their products, but it really is all in the way that you do it. There's a right way and a wrong way to do that. There's a way that you can send manufacturing overseas and maintain quality, and the Germans are good at that because when they put their name on something, they feel like they have an image of quality to protect, and they're not going to put their name on anything that's substandard or subquality. And then the second point I'd like to make about advertising is what's really changed our country, in my opinion, is the advent of modern psychology, from which has spawned what I call Madison Avenue mindset. Some of the most brilliant people in our country work in advertising and work in as consultants and work in fields that are all about the manipulation of thought, okay? And it not only encompasses products, which people are very easily fooled on products because they don't take time to do their homework on quality and do the research. The internet is making that better, so we'll see what the outcome of that is. But if you look at politics, the person there at your studio that said the advertisement has nothing to do with the product, the same goes true with politicians, you know.
But they have
professional advertisers that create an image, create a product that doesn't exist.
And we make a link in our head that is completely irrational. You know,
right.
We vote for George W. We voted for George Bush because we wanted to have a beer with him, which had nothing to do with his ability. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, Charles.
There was a book by George Lakoff called The Political Mind, and I highly recommend that. If you read that book and understand the psychology of politics and how that also permeates into the consumer products that we buy, everything becomes pretty clear. And really, the path back to sanity, back to high quality, is pretty clear as well.
Charles, thanks for the call. Great to have you. And
thank you, guys.
Good to have you in the area.
Okay, so long.
Any book by George Lakoff, Moral Politics, is a very seminal book, which really explains a lot about what's going on.
George Lakoff is a linguist who teaches at Berkeley, and the book that Charles was talking about discusses the way that the political parties use messaging and use symbology and imaging to embed themselves in the minds of voters and how to appeal. But, you know,
can you imagine Mitt Romney in a current situation saying that he's going to, you know, cozy up to women?
Yeah, but look, you were in advertising. Sorry. I got a friend in advertising in New York. The advertisers are going to say, listen, we're just embellishing and bringing out the character attributes of the thing that we are selling possesses. We're simply emphasizing them. We're making them writ large and no? I mean, is there nothing to that?
The Latin word adverto means to warn.
Really?
Yes. It means to warn.
To warn.
And it's like
that's too good.
When I say lying, you're dealing with things that have nothing to do with anything.
Gross, you know, exaggerations of the
Charmin
distortions of the
and
of
Mr.
The truth.
Whipple.
Yeah.
I mean,
all right, let's go.
The sprays that you put on your furniture, like they advertise that it cleans your house. when in fact, what it does is it perfumes your sofa. You know, I mean,
well, look, I mean, shame on us for
cars, luxury, you know, a luxury car driving at 100 miles an hour on an empty road with trees around it. You know, you look at the ads for cars, particularly on cable, because that's where the expensive.
You're like, yeah, I get a vacation with my car.
When are you
that's
ever going to see that? You know, how does the car do? And you know, on the 101 at 5 in the afternoon, you know, when you're bumper to bumper,
right? Ready to kill each other. You just tuned in. You are listening to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold. Joining me is Otis McClay, and also Doyle Odom is who's always joining me, but really joining in today. And why not?
Hey.
And so, if you just tuned into the show started with me describing how my notebook computer died. My 2-year-old HP notebook died in the middle of me presenting a new portfolio to my new clients. And how deeply embarrassing that was.
It's really devastating because it ends up like implying, well, this guy wants to run my portfolio.
Yeah, this guy wants to run my portfolio. He can't even keep his PC running.
And it's a totally questionable connection.
Yeah, I know.
And it's the kind of connection we make as humans.
Believe me, I started.
It's the same connection used in advertising.
Yeah, right.
You know, something has nothing to do with anything else, and somehow we make a connection.
Yeah.
And then have.
So we're talking about product quality, and it's really what I think is a product quality crisis. I came to that conclusion a while ago. I've been feeling that way that there is a bond of trust that has been broken between the manufacturers, the businesses, the retailers, and me as a customer.
But I have
where I feel like when I buy something these days that the odds are very strong, very good. That it is not going to survive as long as it should. It's not going to work. It's going to break. It's going to be defective. I'm going to be stuck on customer support lines with frustration, and that this has become a common way with the way of purchasing products that are manufactured. And it didn't used to be that way.
I'm sticking to my thought that it has to do with the focus on the bottom line, the immediate bottom line, not the long term.
Let's see what Diane has to say about it. Diane, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, yeah, part of the bottom line, you get what you pay for, right?
Yep. No.
So
I don't agree with that at all, Diane.
Huh?
I don't think you get what you pay for.
Well, here's
I think you
pay
very expensive products that are no good.
We're also getting products being demanded at a lower price. So the only way, not the only way, one of the major ways that manufacturers or companies can make things at a lower price is they use cheaper materials and cheaper resources, i.e. people. So let's say you get an IT developer that charges $75 an hour in the U.S., but you can send it offshore for $25.
Yes. No,
the manufacturer
totally
makes
agree.
More money. They can lower the cost and... What happens to the consumer that was making $75 an hour? He's out of a job. He's at Walmart looking to find stuff that is cheaper because he's having to live in unemployment.
Yeah, don't forget that Ford, who was, you know, a total anti-communist, an extreme capitalist, wanted to pay his workers well.
Yep.
So that they could buy Fords.
Exactly.
I mean, and we've completely lost that.
Completely.
But then when we have what is it, 70% of the wealth of the nation is in the hands of less than 1%?
Yep.
It's actually less.
The little pricks.
There's the 0.1% that owns a huge amount. That raises serious questions. You know, A, what do they need all that money for? What are they afraid of? And B, you know, do you want to have a nation that's, you know, people who don't have money? That's crazy.
I think you referred to this one time as Calvinism.
They only need so many HP laptops.
Say it again, Diane.
They only need so many HP computers.
Yeah.
So there's no incentive for, you know, to make a higher quality product for them or for the worker.
And I also think there's been a move away from craft. You know,
there's
certain crafts that we teach in radio that I've taught, and I've seen people come in. Craft is something you learn by doing.
Tradesmen.
And
unions. Oh, my God, it's a bad word. Heaven
what?
Forbid.
Say it.
Tradesmen and union, she said.
Yes, it's a bad
classically,
word. Heaven forbid.
Classically, you apprenticed yourself to somebody to learn that trade, to learn that craft.
Exactly.
Right? And that you learned it. By doing you cleaned the temple, you know hauled and carried, and then you were allowed to, you know, and as you developed this, you became really good at what you do, and eventually you could make a Stradivarius.
Exactly.
We've moved away from that. I've taught classes and people come in with a piece of paper and they're going to write down the craft.
Uh-huh.
And somehow by academicizing this, but
how
it's
many,
not the same as doing.
How many fresh college grads do you want fixing your plumbing when you got a leak in a pipe?
It used to be.
Or your car mechanic.
Plumbing is a hard thing to do, Diane. I can
it
attest
is.
To that.
But you don't get a college degree to go be a plumber. That's a craftsman. That's a trade that has to be learned.
It's a hard deal. Plumbing.
And we sort of don't respect it.
And we should, because we pay them a lot of money to fix it.
I respect it. I've tried to do it. Diane, great to have you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, we've we got a full lineup here of our callers, so let's get to it. Chuck is next. Chuck, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Oh, welcome, panel. Thanks for having me on.
Yep.
Listen, I just wanted to point something. I know you had a little press for time now, so I'll be brief on my points.
Okay.
There's a gentleman that I was talking to from South Africa said, if you want a socialistic economy to work, and he pointed out Sweden, he pointed out Australia. They don't really proclaim themselves as socialist, so to speak, with not most of them, but if you look at the way it is, they are. I mean, we're talking about $4 a gallon of gas. They pay about $12 a liter. It's like, ugh.
Which is more what the real cost
is. Yeah, but Chuck, those economies also must, I assume, and I feel pretty sure, leave plenty of room as well for individual portions of the economy.
Oh, they do. No, I'm not contesting that. But
why do we call them socialist economies if they are in fact both?
He was explaining to me, and it seems to make sense, and I just wanted to get your view on it, was that you need three things. You need an infrastructure already established, okay? Number two, you need a high GDP. I think that's what it's called, you know, gross domestic product. You need money coming in, basically. And this is the third thing, and he explained to me this is why it probably won't work in the United States like it does in Australia. You need a small population.
I think all that's nonsense, what this guy said to you.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's why I'm going.
I question it.
I think it's nonsense. I think you have to have a population that knows how to invest capital wisely in order to get a return on it, mm-hmm. a true return.
You have to have a concept of what capitalism is.
Well, that goes back to
how it works.
Chuck, thanks for the call. Investing in things that help you. You know,
GDP has nothing to do with a healthy economy. It has to do with a sizable amount of activity.
Yeah,
the Gulf oil spill
and hurricanes. Which is great for the GDP.
Right, and as Warren Buffett, as I'd like to point out, it's just great the way he puts it. He says, "I've got enough money." He's got $50 billion. He says, "I could employ everyone in the country to paint my portrait every single day." Oh, that's a lot of GDP going down. But is that a productive endeavor that advances the economy? The answer is no. So the only thing that an economy needs is the ability to invest capital wisely at good rates of return, and to do that you have to cost out capital properly. You can't undercost capital.
Well, I was going to say something about value added, because value added is really where the wealth comes from.
That's right.
You know, the gold in the ground is great,
yeah.
But you know, when you dig it up, you're adding value.
Yeah.
Well, we've moved away from that.
You
in
have
this
to
country,
have,
we don't really add much value. There's very little value being added in a Wall Street transaction.
It's great.
Occasionally
notice.
It works
it's
out.
Such a key idea, the idea of value added. So
are the richest people in this country now basically are people who do not add value?
Well, you say that, but...
Well, I know you're in the business, so but, I'm sure that there
But there are,
people,
are a lot of businesses that get created, and I think that a lot of reward should accrue to people like Steve Jobs and people like
broker.
Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg. These are world-changing people who create businesses and value, as it were.
But yeah. If you were a real broker, the way brokers were probably, 100 years ago, a broker would be somebody who would connect you, where you have some money, with somebody who's doing something.
Well, we talked about this.
Yeah, I know. This is what you talk about on the show, and I'm saying that's a positive thing. Now the capital's going to generate some value. The capital's doing something useful.
You know,
it's not just going into a place where it's going to sit there.
It's a very interesting time, I've thought about doing a show on websites like Kickstarter. I don't know if you've heard of Kickstarter, mm-hmm. but Kickstarter is a web...
I've done a video for Kickstarter.
Yeah, it's a web-based way of funding projects, where you, as a small investor, can send money to certain businesses or projects. It could be producing an album. Any kind of stuff like that shows up on Kickstarter. You know, we can do that now. The internet is really having an interesting effect on how we can take our own financial capital and put it into projects without having to go through Wall Street middlemen and IPOs and all this other stuff. So, I think it's a fascinating time, Otis, and I think 10 years from now, there are going to be several of those websites and systems mm-hmm. that are really going to be effective ways and have proven themselves as ways to move capital to projects that are worthy. Just FYI, that's what I think. Anyway.
And that's what the stock market was. The stock market was a way of giving capital to people who were doing things. That was what it was.
Yeah.
mean,
right. And now pretty much the stock market is a way to
derivatives. I mean, what's a derivative?
Well, right. Well, it's a risk management instrument. That's my short answer.
Betting on the Standard & Poor's?
Well, it may not be betting. It may be insuring a position that you already have, right? I mean, let's say insuring
is not betting?
No, I wouldn't say insuring is betting.
Okay.
So let's say you have a large position in something. Maybe you've owned it for a long time, or maybe you bought Apple Computer at $2 a share and you now own a huge amount of it and you're worried that it's going to drop in value. You can go buy a put option.
Right, okay.
Which will insure the position.
Well, puts and calls are
that's what a derivative
forward.
Is.
Well, but they're pretty close derivatives.
It's a derivative.
They're not derivatives that are 50 times removed.
Yeah, that's true.
Like
that's
the CDOs.
They're a first order derivative. I agree. Okay, let's go back. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left in the show, and Lori is holding on line 6. Lori, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thanks for having me. I'm enjoying your program.
Thank you.
At the risk of sounding ultra layman or ultra simplistic, I agree with you that the implicit sort of contract between the consumer and manufacturers and businesses over the past 50, 60, 70 years has changed. And it has always occurred to me that way back in the day when things were being manufactured and they were built to last is because there seemed to be a growing market and room for the economy to grow things like that. But when you look at it, I mean, if you bought something that lasts and that worked, then you would keep it. Which means somebody would not have to make that product anymore.
Yep.
Then somebody would be out of a job. And I think that's where the contract is broken. Here's my example, and then I'll take the comments off the air.
Yeah.
The company Curtis Mathis. Remember the Curtis Mathis TV?
Yep.
In the 80s, I think they were advertising that those TVs were built to last. Yep. And they were built to last. Curtis Mathis is not in existence today.
Nope.
They were built to last.
Lori, thanks.
Nobody needs to buy them.
Thank you for the call. Otis,
there's a great scene in Pinky Boots.
This idea of planned obsolescence. I mean, some of it, honestly, must be due to the fact that technological standards are changing rapidly. Lori mentioned Curtis Mathis, and of course, the whole delivery of television has changed to flat panel and digital in nature. Curtis Mathis was an analog maker of high quality and some may argue over-engineered. Where is the balance that manufacturers should be going for between planned obsolescence, where they know that nobody's going to want to own this particular product because it literally is going to be obsolete in 5 years' time or 3 years' time, so they don't want to put so much into it that it's meant to last for 20 years. Because if you're going to make it last for 20 years, it's going to be much more over-engineered. But it seems to me that we're failing on the other side. They're making these things last way too short of a time. And it's causing, to me at least, in my personal experience, enormous frustration as I pay money and don't get anything for it.
I think there's planned obsolescence, which is to engineer something so that it will fail. And that was particularly interesting, I think, in cars. You know, our pattern is supposed to be buy a new car every 2 years.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of people do.
Used to, but not, but now,
well,
I mean,
not
people
now.
Are driving 8 to 10 years.
I have a Saturn, which is 10 years old. It's got 170,000-180,000 miles on it. It works great.
Yeah.
That's why GM dumped them. Because the car they were building was really too good.
Yeah.
But there are also things like computers where the technology itself is evolving. But I don't think that Apple has made the choice to reduce the quality of manufacture just because obviously we're going to come up with a new chip in 2 years that's going to be better. You'll buy it anyway. The old one to somebody else.
We got an iMac in our home 6 years ago.
I have one too.
It's still going and still runs great runs fine.
That's my main computer.
And look at the result of Apple's approach. Apple is now the most valuable company in the world.
Yes.
The products are trusted. I know they've got manufacturing labor problems that they've got to address, and hopefully they will. But in terms of the engineering of the products and the design choices that they've made, I feel like they have made the right choices, where HP, I've had nothing but problems. And by the way, the one that died today is not the only one I've had problems with. I bought a printer. Yeah. I bought a printer a year ago. I've been through 5 replacements of it, and I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
I counted it. I've had to send it back and back and back. They sent, you know, this one was leaking ink. This one was sucking the paper in wrong and mangling the pages in the scanner. This one was not able to communicate with the
well, we also have to say,
PC. Another one was dropping pages that it was scanning.
HP's been through a lot, as we recall.
Yeah, right. So I mean, maybe the whole theme of this show is it's time for Leo to quit buying HP, and I would agree. A few minutes left. Let's take Tag on line three. Tag, welcome to the show.
Hey, Leo, I just want you to think about this for a minute. You know, you have a problem with your consumer quality, but, you know, you would think that would lead back to the manufacturer quality aspect, and there's a big disconnect there. And my wife works in a supplier quality in the manufacturing field, and lots of times the supplier quality is used as a tool to drive down the price of what your suppliers are bringing into you. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you have a problem, and they don't even really go out and find out what the problem is. It might be in the manufacturing, the darn thing right in the factory. But they come back and they say, well, this is our supplier's problem. And so we want you to go back and with the supplier so that we can get cheaper prices. Or if we want to drop the supplier for another supplier for cheaper prices, we can do that because of these complaints, and they never really even go back and see what the real problem was. You track with me on that, Leo?
Well, what I hear you saying, Tag, is that this is a planned approach by manufacturers, modern manufacturers. They use it as a weapon and as a business tactic in their operations.
And not only that, and here's where the rubber really meets the road, is that the guys who are at the top echelon of the factories are the ones, or the corporations are the ones that are really making the money in the in the value when they have their options come due and they can get all this stuff.
Tag, great to have you. Got to run. We're out of time. Johnny, I'm sorry we didn't get to you today. I think that's a great point.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Otis, it's great. You bailed me out.
No,
it's a pleasure.
I didn't have anything else to do.
And it's a pleasure to be on the radio with a true professional like you. Doyle,
thank you.
Thanks so much, as always, for engineering, newcapitalshow.com. And please friend me on Facebook.
Have I friended you?
No, I don't think so yet. But please do. LeoGold.newcapitalshow. Take care, everybody. Back next week.
This is Dr. Drew Houlihan, principal of Parker Elementary School, reminding you that April is National Poetry Month. In celebration, Writers in the Schools is offering a poem a day, showcasing poetry written by local children. Parker Elementary is pleased to participate by sharing these poems with you on KPFT through the voices of our own talented students. And now, here is your poem of the day.
Hi, my name is J.C. Jameson, and I'm in the fourth grade at Parker Elementary. Here is a poem by Anna, who is in the third grade. A dancer's house. This house is very empty. There are only cleared out spaces, but this house has something special. This house is a dreamer. It wakes me up early in the morning so that I can dance to its ancient song of praise. This house is set where two rivers meet and rush. Have you ever danced until the thieving sunset stole your light of day? Because I have in my house. The blue stones in the rain are the music that I dance to. My house is made of brick and wood, but my house has a soul. Believe it. My house is old, but comfortable. I touch the rusted pipes that still let me live. My pliés and pirouettes are better when I'm in my house on the top floor. My blood pumping out imagination until the day draws to its close. I leap and bound on my garden path. I skip across the quiet river. A peaceful house. A peaceful setting. A dancer's house.
This has been the Wits Poem of the Day. I'm Leslie Hokanson, fourth grade.